Welcome to the Gestalt IT Rundown, where each time we meet, we run down the IT news of the week with a variable degree of snarkiness. I'm your host, Tom Hollingsworth. No, I'm not. I'm your host, Stephen Foskett. And joining me today, since Tom is out at Networking Field Day, is my co-host, Mr. Brian Knutson. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Stephen. I'm excited to be here with you.
It's good to have you. You know, I like you better than Tom.
Oh.
No, don't tell him that. He won't watch this, will he?
Well, probably not.
What's the worst that could happen? It is actually National Bagel Day today. My favorite kind of bagel is a garlic bagel, but you have to eat them fresh because after a day, the garlic gets all slimy and nasty. What's your favorite bagel, Brian?
I think my favorite is probably the cinnamon crunch from Panera. At the risk of choosing a chain, that I don't know. It's hard to beat that crunchiness that you get along with it.
Yeah, I gotcha. Though I have to say, a really fresh egg bagel is a thing of beauty, even though they're hard to get these days.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a look at some of the things that are going on in the world of enterprise IT this week. First off, a hacker group managed to access a Microsoft crypto key that they utilized to create forged tokens that allowed them to access Microsoft Cloud email accounts, including U.S. government accounts like the Commerce Secretary. As a result, Microsoft has rescinded the key and expanded cloud logging for standard customers. Brian, what do you make of this story?
Yeah, this one's an interesting one. It's had a lot of twists and turns as it's been reported out over the last couple of weeks. The security research team at Wiz has speculated that it may be a lot deeper, a lot more dangerous than what Microsoft's admitting to at this point, which is maybe the scariest part of the whole story right now. But really what the key was internal to Microsoft, which means somehow they got inside of Microsoft, were able to get that. So there's speculation around whether they were able to do anything else while they were in there. That key then was used, like you mentioned, to be able to create a access token that they were able to access all these email accounts. So how widespread that was is still a mystery at this point. Microsoft's released some information, but not everything that the security industry is really kind of looking for to better understand it. To me, this really highlights the importance of detect and response, being able to find aberrant behaviors. And that's essentially how the U.S. government managed to find this so quickly, was the fact that they saw data being transferred in ways that normally wouldn't be. And so they raised the flag on that and discovered that something was going on, which is really the important part of that detect phase is finding that behavior. There's a lot of comparisons here to what happened with SolarWinds and the ability to get into a supply chain provider and be able to attack downstream customers. And of course, this has the cloud element to it where, that key was utilized across multiple cloud solutions, multiple software as a service solutions within the Microsoft suite. So being able to have that clean supply chain and being able to detect those types of breaches are really the important lesson here. So Samsung has unveiled new GDDR7 memory, which is kind of the next big thing in high-speed memory technology. This new memory ought to be 33% faster than GDDR6, with data rates reaching up to 32 gigabits per second per pin, which is pretty amazing. Samsung's is also 20% more power efficient, which is pretty important, and not quite keeping pace with performance. Although we won't see them for another year or two, we expect to see it take hold, especially in the graphics and AI space. Stephen, what do you think about this?
Yeah, I think that the importance of these announcements, these new memory announcements, and we've got some more coming, I hear, as well, is more in what they promise for the future, and especially for memory-hungry applications. So as a reminder, GDDR is mainly used on in graphics, AI, HPC kind of platforms. We are currently in a DDR5 and 6 world. And GDDR7 was widely expected. There are some differences. It's got a new signaling type. But generally speaking, this is sort of the next predictable stage. The thing that's important about this story, number one, is that Samsung is sampling this memory, which means that the parts that are going to use this, the components that are going to use this, are almost certainly in active development, and we'll see those announced soon. The other point to make about this is that the of all the applications in the world that need more memory, machine learning training is the one. And having another memory technology, a faster memory technology that can really deliver the goods in ML training is really going to help. So more than on your home game GPU, I think that GDDR7 is going to have an impact in the AI space. And frankly, that's really what Samsung is hoping for. As a reminder, they're really trying to push in and make themselves a leader in chip making in certain areas. And I think that memory is a real good place for Samsung to be. So overall, interesting story, but one that we won't really know the impact of for another few months until we start seeing parts at the market. Millions of computers are facing critical firmware vulnerabilities in baseband management controllers, BMCs, made by AMI, exposed during a ransomware attack a few years ago. These vulnerabilities enable malicious actors to gain super user access through the Redfish remote management interface, potentially compromising sensitive cloud environments and leading to ransomware attacks or severe system damage. What action is needed to address these security flaws and safeguard the technology supply chain?
Yeah, this one's a scary one. This brings back memories of Ghost Inspector to me, where you know it's just so deep embedded that it's important to remind yourself as to how to try to prevent these from being big issues to begin with. I believe that there were two RCs issued for this that had scores of 8+. I think one was a 9.9. So super critical to pay attention to. You know, this goes into computers manufactured by Gigabyte, Intel, AMD, and you know, go back to, like you said, a ransomware attack that happened. So the BMC, if people aren't familiar with that, tend to be that kind of out of band management system. So those that, you know, have lived like me in the compact HPE world for years are super familiar with ILO. So similar system there, which means that they've got, you know, below root access in some ways. So being able to protect those is critical to begin with. You know, best practices, put them on a separate instance, ideally air gapped, make it so that you've got to go through some sort of remote access in order to get it. Even if you're on the network, having to make that extra hop in order to protect it. So it's super important to make sure that you've got that separation there, that they can be extra protected. You know, supply chain is a big piece of the story as well, being able to identify the fact that you've got a supply chain provider that's got something in there, making sure that you're looking for this kind of stuff. You know, sometimes these aren't as big a deal as this one is. And this is a good reminder that, you know, no matter how small the vulnerability is, it could be combined with other vulnerabilities to create a bigger one. And making sure you've got that protected and you're looking for those supply chain issues is a key lesson to be learned here. Intel introduced two new x86-64 instruction sets this week called Intel APX that provide better efficiency for the x86-based workloads and AVX-10 supporting the AVX-512 across all cores of hybrid processor designs. AVX-10 replaces the AVX-512 but remains backward compatible. What do these mean for the battle between Intel and AMD, Stephen?
Yeah, there's two things going on here. So first, on the APX, this is all about Intel trying to push forward in terms of performance. So APX, the big deal here is that they're adding new registers and register-based operations, which should result in higher performance. This is more of an Intel, Intel adding more instructions to the already pretty heavy x64 world. But frankly, these are some instructions that are pretty useful because essentially register loads, register moves, and so on. These are things that happen quite a lot in everyday computing. And APX has a lot of useful tools that ought to accelerate performance. So I think that once this gets implemented, once we have servers that support this and compilers that support this, it'll help Intel launch a little bit forward in terms of overall CPU performance, which of course Intel loves. Not sure yet if AMD is going to adopt these instructions, but you know, maybe they will. On the other hand, AVX10, I think, is an interesting thing because it shows, well, another aspect of the battle between AMD and Intel. So as we've talked about on the rundown, Intel announced a sort of a performance and efficiency core strategy, heterogeneous computing, where in the same chip, it'll have two different core types. It'll have a performance core and an efficiency core. One of the aspects of that that's been a little challenging is that the efficiency cores and performance cores don't support all the same instructions. And one of those big instructions is AVX 512. This is an advanced vector math instruction set that has been very useful in machine learning tasks and so on. But the fact that the efficiency cores don't support these commands means that, they may not get as much used, because if dynamically the system is switching between performance and efficiency, and if it can only use these commands on one type of core, that means that it can't dynamically switch between performance and efficiency. On AMD's part, they have not gone the E-core route, and instead, with Bergamo, what we've seen is sort of a stripped-down performance core, a compressed, compacted performance core that allows them to pack more cores in, but they're not a different core type. They're really the same Zen 4 cores that you might see across the rest of the AMD line. So importantly, that means that they all support the same instruction set. So Intel, by doing AVX10, one of the things that they're doing here is they're trying to bring a little bit of homogeneity to their heterogeneous compute instruction sets by bringing these AVX 512 commands to the efficiency cores. It's not happening right now, but it will happen. And I think that what we're seeing here is essentially the next, round of development in this whole battle between AMD and Intel, and between performance and efficiency cores and accelerated commands and so on. And frankly, this is going to help, because it will help the adoption of that sort of heterogeneous compute architecture by having at least some of the same commands supported on both sides. Speaking of processor cores, Debian has officially announced that RISC-V is an officially supported architecture. This is a significant move for the RISC-V community. While the official archive currently has limited content, this acceptance marks the beginning of increased support and development for RISC-V in Debian. As RISC-V gains interest as an alternative CPU architecture, is this a signal moment showing that RISC-V is gaining widestream adoption?
Yeah, I think this is huge. Anytime that you get a OS core supporting a very specific architecture like this is a big move for that community. And to your point, this is a community. This is an open source architecture, which is fairly new, fairly unique in this space. And I see a lot of advantages, a lot of synergy with the Linux community, of course, being very open source in a lot of places. And despite all of the Red Hat stuff going on, the fights around that and closed sourcing some of these operating systems, Linux ultimately is built out of the open source. So being able to see them supporting the RISC-V architecture, being able to have those two communities working more closely together, I think is going to be an interesting thing to watch. Debian being early in that space to do it, obviously Debian is upstream from a lot of other operating systems, a lot of other distributions of Linux. So we're going to see that slipping into other places based on this. Again, this is an announcement ahead of the actual what's going to happen, but long term, we're going to see this start to have a toehold in the environment to do more with that. So it's exciting to see that recognition. It's exciting to see these two communities starting to work closer together to develop something that will go out there and make this new architecture out there. Obviously, we've seen a lot with the not only the AMD Intel battles, But as we look across other architectures, there's a lot of interest in having other architectures out there. The most obvious of which is the ARM architecture, which we've been looking at as being the big thing for doing low power, to being able to be more mobile, but has started to become more wieldy than maybe people expected. So having some other options out there is always good. I was always a fan of RISC architectures back in the day. And I never really felt like they got their due, being stuck in the supercomputer space. So being able to see this start moving into the standard system space is kind of exciting to me. World's largest PCIe SSD was just revealed by Solidigm. Utilizing QLC flash, the new D5P5336 will be available in just over 60 terabytes of capacity in some form factors. This is a capacity optimized SSD intended to complement the D5P5430, which we covered back in May. What's the use of such a large SSD, Stephen?
Well, there's something to be said for introducing the world's largest anything, and Solidigm, well, they did it, though asterisk, sort of. First off, it's important to realize that this is very, very early in the launch phase, brand new product just being launched. I don't know if the 60 terabyte models are actually shipping. In fact, I'm not sure when they would be shipping, but they'll ship eventually. And certainly this platform will support that kind of capacity. It's obviously been designed for it. That's on the roadmap. That's one of the things that they're going to be doing. And it probably will be the first 60 terabyte class PCIe SSD. And now, why is this important? Well, capacity is always important. These SSDs are being used across the industry. We are seeing more and more discussion of all-flash architectures from companies like Pure Storage and Vast and NetApp and others, really taking on majority mainstream workloads and increasingly moving into more niche and capacity workloads as well, displacing hard disks and things like backup and archive and data warehouses and so on that you might not have thought that flash could go. Of course, these chips, some people have been concerned about them because generally high capacity SSDs are using QLC, which is a technology that some people are concerned about in terms of reliability and performance. Also, because some of the early world's fastest world's largest SSDs, sorry about that, some of the earlier attempts to get this large were, let's say, not the most impressive engineering techniques. In fact, there's already a 60 terabyte class SAS SSD, but it's really more like three SSDs in one case, kind of all combined and smushed in together. And it really doesn't offer much in terms of performance. It's just a capacity SSD. The nice thing about what Solidigm's doing here is that this is a company with really impressive engineering resources to back this thing up. They've been shipping QLC for a long, long time, multiple generations. They make their own flash, so they really know it well. In fact, they use floating gate QLC, unlike the rest of the industry, which has added a charge trap to that. I imagine that Solidigm will be moving into the charge trap world soon, but with this type of NAND flash. But for now, they're able to deliver a completely integrated SSD. This guy apparently uses the same controller as the P5430, which is more of a performance offering. But by packing in more flash in the larger physical form factors like the E1L, they're going to be able to deliver this kind of capacity. But more importantly, they're going to be able to deliver reliability and, well, some levels of performance as well on this thing. Plus, of course, this is all PCIe. That's what the P stands for, which means that inherently it's the latest generation in terms of I/O access and that sort of thing. So overall, Solidigm's delivering yet another really impressive SSD here with the D5 P5336. It complements the D5 P5430, as well as the much larger or much faster SSDs that they also make. And it allows them to kind of blaze a trail in a new market here and support new applications that need incredible capacity. I guess I'll leave you on that. 60 terabytes in a rack is going to be able to deliver like petabyte scale storage, which is just fantastic and really changes the game in terms of needing lots of big, heavy, hot spinning disks in capacity applications. Now let's take a closer look at another story. Now we talk about cybersecurity a lot, and yeah, we're going to talk about it again this week because there's more news, and frankly, because it's something that affects all of us. It's dominating the headlines with persistent threats, with sophisticated attacks, but also with some attacks that are not so sophisticated. So we recently talked about the stolen Microsoft keys. We've also talked about the MoveIt file transfer hack. And these show that these security breaches can be both severe and complex, but sometimes minor errors can also lead to significant consequences, as demonstrated by the inadvertent sending of sensitive military emails to the wrong destination due to a typo. Also this week, we learned of the passing of a hacking legend, Mr. Kevin Mitnick, and this has sort of captured the attention of the cybersecurity industry and shows his long-term impact on the industry and the field. So I guess let's start with a closer look at some of these stories. Brian?
Yeah, I'm particularly interested in this inadvertent email leak of military emails that really kind of come down to simple typo. Like, the simplest thing can still screw up security for us. So the story there is that, we're used to in the United States having all of our military under the .mil subdomain or top level domain, sorry, which is oddly similar to Molly's top level domain of .ml. So simply dropping off that I, you're sending, instead of sending a what may be some sensitive data, maybe being sent to a whole other country, one that happens to be aligned with Russia and not necessarily U.S. friendly, instead of going to another military email address. And the guy that is in charge of running the .ml top level domain has actually raised his flag to the military several times based on the reporting I've seen. So you got to be careful about those types of things. You got to build systems that will catch simple mistakes like that. It sometimes as simple as you pick up all of the misspellings of whatever company name you have so that no one else can squat on those or can create security traps around that.
Isn't it funny that the smallest errors can create big consequences? This is not the first time that we've seen things like typos leading to security breaches, though I would mention that there's some funny interactions when it comes to emails and email addresses. I'm not sure if you've noticed this, but sometimes nowadays mail clients will cache or remember addresses. They will substitute addresses. They're being helpful, and I think increasingly with machine learning being implemented everywhere, we're going to see more and more of this where your client may decide, you meant Bryant Newsom, or not Bryant Knudsen, right? And I think that that actually opens up a whole new avenue of security vulnerabilities, because somebody could, for example, send an email to somebody in the military from, army.ml, I'm making that one up, instead of army.mil, and your client may decide, that must be the correct address, and automatically fill that in. Just this week, I got some fairly sensitive tax return information sent to somebody with a very similar name of mine on Gmail. I get that stuff all the time, And I'm sure you do too. It's a yeah. funny situation, but it really reflects a potential security vulnerability, but also the kind of social engineering that has been used to lead to security breaches over the years, wouldn't you say?
Oh, definitely. You know, being able to just make a simple mistake. We've seen this with some of the large learning models too. Of, you know, if you inject enough of bad data, it suddenly becomes the reality that large learning model lives on, and makes it easy to be able to inject bad code into these automatic programming situations. But to me, one of the biggest things with the story too is, don't send sensitive information via email. Like, even if you're on the same domain, email shouldn't be considered a secure mechanism for anything sensitive. So I'm always pretty careful, and it can be tough with family members sometimes, like, oh, well, just send that social security number to me via email. I'm like, yeah, no, I don't like that idea. That seems like a bad idea. How about we both jump on Signal or one of the secure messaging situations? So again, sometimes the simple things are the things that can protect you the best.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it does remind me of the MOVEit attack, which we've been talking about here, where essentially people are trying to use secure systems. And yet, what if the secure system is breached? Or what if we're centralizing things? Or what if we're not using it correctly? Again, these are one of the things that affects me all the time. Like you mentioned, as a business owner, I have to deal with tax forms, you know, validation, you know, credit card processing, all those things. And I really try to be secure, and I try to use these secure systems. But I have to say, these secure systems are not great. I've used quite a few of them. And I've used MOVEit, and I like MOVEit. I felt like it was a pretty good system. Unfortunately, it was breached.
And again, this harkens back to SolarWinds, where people were trusting SolarWinds to a level that they may not trust most of their own admins, the level of access it had, and something slipped into that. So I harp on it a lot, because I think it's an area that most people don't think about enough, but I've seen enough that scares me, is the whole supply chain aspect of things can be really, really scary. And you see the government, the US government particularly, starting to put some stuff out there to try and put some control around it. But yeah, I mean, don't get hung up on complex situations. Sometimes there's nothing you can do about it. Like, you've got to trust some tools to some level. Do your due diligence, make sure you truly do trust them, and then protect yourself should something bad happen there.
Yeah, and I want to finish up today's rundown with a reminiscence of somebody who passed away this week. So we learned that Kevin Mitnick, famous hacker, I think that he would be happy to be called that, died this week of pancreatic cancer. Kevin was somebody who banged the drum on security his entire life. I encountered Kevin way back when I was still in college. Look at this hair. When I was in college, I encountered him on the Usenet. And, you know, this is someone who taught us all quite a lot about penetration testing, finding vulnerabilities, exploiting vulnerabilities. Let me say that his life was a lesson to me and what not to do, and also what to do, because you know, the guy talked a lot about social engineering and inadvertent security issues, just like the things we've been talking about. I'm sure that if Kevin was here, he would be talking about the .ml, .mil fiasco and bringing up a lot of the same issues. You know, certainly he will be missed. He was an important figure in the world of security. And we're sad to hear of this news.
Yeah, definitely. I was able to hear him speak at a VMUG UserCon conference back in 2014 in Kansas City. And it was fascinating hearing his story and the lessons he learned. And, you know, it's a bit of a redemption story, where he did go to prison and spend time there because of his illicit activities, and he came out of there a reformed person and used those experiences, used that knowledge to try to better at for other companies. You know, he truly switched sides in that regard, and was really cool to hear his story. He was happy to get out and tell the story and be able to help others learn from what he learned and his story. So yeah, we'll definitely be missed having him in the industry.
Yep. Our condolences to his family and friends.
Yep.
So before we go, just a quick reminder of what's going on this week. First off, Networking Field Day is happening right now. Tom Hollingsworth is out there in California. We're going to hear from Broadcom. We're going to hear from Niall and Anuta. Also from our great panel of delegates. You can find out more and learn about that at techfieldday.com. And you can watch those live presentations on LinkedIn. Also, we've got VMware Explore coming up. We will be there. VMware is going to be presenting NSX to the group. And I'm happy to announce that AMD will also be presenting to the Tech Field Day group at Tech Field Day Extra at VMware Explore. So please do check out information about that here on techfieldday.com. As for me, I'm looking forward to hopefully attending Flash Memory Summit, Storage Developer Conference, OCP Summit. We're planning for a lot of future Field Day events. So please do connect with us on that. Thanks for joining us this week on the Gestalt IT Rundown. You can catch new episodes every Wednesday as a YouTube video, or you can find us in your favorite podcast application. Just look for Gestalt IT Rundown. We'll be back next Wednesday to talk about all of the IT news of the week that was. But until then, for myself, for Brian, for Tom Hollingsworth, and for all of us in the Gestalt IT family, here's wishing you and yours a great International Bagel Day.